This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. The late 60s and 70s was a time of upheaval and creativity. Our guest, writer and critic Richard Zoglin, says stand-up comics are the forgotten stars of this era. On the program today, we'll look back at the comics who Richard Zoglin says, following in the footsteps of Lenny Bruce, transformed the culture, comics like George Carlin, Richard Pryor, and Robert Klein. Zoglin says these comics came along at a time when the nation's power structure was being challenged, and they struck a responsive chord. They, too, were challenging the status quo, and their comedy was political. In his words, they were great democratic artists whose power depended on forging an intimate bond with the audience. He also makes this observation. The old comics made jokes about real life. The new comics turned real life into the joke. Let's listen to one of the forgotten stars. Here's Dick Gregory from the album Dick Gregory's Frankenstein.
I really had a strange trip. I meant on the plane. I stayed up late last night because I was had a lot of paperwork I had to do, but knowing I had to make this trip here, I didn't mind it too much because I knew I could get me some sleep on the plane. So dig it, I get on the plane and rush to my seat, sit down, and it's a white cat sitting next to me. So naturally, I check him out. Now let me say this to you, I always haven't had to check out white folks. Now, this is something new happened about 10 months ago in Chicago, one night, walking downtown in the Loop, up on the sidewalk, minding my own business, whistling a little tune. I dig it, there's a white cat walking toward me. Well, he see me coming, and he jumped all the way off the sidewalk and get in the gutter. Right? I dig it. As I approach him, very nervously, he said, mister, you're not going to bother me. You're not going to hurt me, are you, mister? I said, no, boy. So then I told him who I was. I said, I'm Dick Gregory, dedicated and committed to nonviolence. Oh, that kind of eased his nerves. Yeah, he said, you mean you are the Mr. Dick Gregory? I said, that's right, my man. He said, you mean, mister, you don't carry no gun or no knife? I said, no, gun or no knife. He said, mister, you mean you don't do no shooting or cutting? I said, no, shooting or cutting. He said, you mean you really dedicated to nonviolence, boy? I said, yassir. He jumped up out of that gutter and said, well, stick him up, nigga. Ever since that day, I've been checking out white folks.
Dick Gregory from the album Dick Gregory's Frankenstein. Our guest Richard Zoglin tells the stories of the times and the comics in the new book Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. Listeners, I invite you to join us with a telephone call this afternoon. We look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Richard Zoglin, our guest, is an editor and writer at Time Magazine, where he is the magazine's theater critic. Previously, he was the magazine's television critic. Over the years, he has written many cover stories, including stories on Bill Cosby, David Letterman, and Arsenio Hall. His book, Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America, is published by Bloomsbury. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Richard Zoglin, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, great to be here.
Hey, I wanted to begin with Dick Gregory for a couple of reasons. One, because he's so political and he's so brilliant. And another reason I wanted to begin with him, because he called Lenny Bruce the eighth wonder of the world. And you note in the book, Comedy at the Edge, it all started with Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, Lenny Bruce was, Dick Gregory was a very important precursor too. He was doing, obviously, very socially relevant comedy on the race situation. And here was a black guy talking to white audiences and, you know, having fun with the race situation. Lenny Bruce was also, of course, talking about topical social and political issues, but doing it in a kind of more insurrectionist way, really calling into question all sort of middle class values and, using the words you weren't supposed to use. And he was a guy, he showed that stand-up comedian could be a social commentator, not just a guy telling jokes, but a guy commenting on social reality. And two, he showed that a stand-up comedian could be a rebel. He was the guy who was, you know, calling into question everything we took for granted. And three, he showed that stand-up comedy could be an incredibly personal art form. You know, Lenny Bruce, through his whole life on stage, everything that he was thinking, everything that was going on in his life, from his women to his politics, it was unbelievable when you saw Lenny Bruce, you know, performance. You were just totally sucked into his world. So that's what I thought was what really revolutionized stand-up comedy in the 60s and what the younger comedians took from.
Yeah. The comics that you spoke with, for Comedy at the Edge, what kinds of things did they tell you about Lenny Bruce?
Well, what they said, first of all, was this was a guy that showed me that a stand-up comedian could be a really intelligent social commentator, not just a guy telling jokes. I mean, it was the intelligence, and the guy read the papers. Some of the things he said even back then were very ahead of the time, and today may look a little passé. But in the 50s, when he would make fun of how to talk to colored people at parties, making fun of white liberals and how they try to make colored people feel comfortable by saying, "Hey, that Jackie Robinson, great ball player," you know, it's kind of a cliche now, but back then that was really, you know, fairly shocking stuff. And that when stand-up comedy at that time mostly was guys telling jokes, borscht belt kind of jokes about mothers-in-law and, you know, kids and wives and stuff, and sort of interchangeable jokes. Here was a guy who read the papers and who was really, you know, doing groundbreaking, commentary on what was happening in society and the culture.
Yeah. Another edgy comic, Richard Pryor, also an African-American, and one of the things that you say about Pryor that is important to his comedy and how audiences responded to him is this. You say his comedy went beyond race. Quote, he plunged without restraint into his own messy personal life. Is that approach to plunge into the messiness of life a common element in the work of the comics of the late 60s and early 70s?
Yeah, it was with a lot of them. I think Pryor, though, was the most extreme example. And he was an interesting guy because he was another African-American comic who talked to crossover audiences. But he, unlike Gregory, who was kind of a cool, sort of laid-back guy who talked about the race issue as, did sort of political commentary, Pryor really sort of dredged up all of his experiences growing up in the Peoria ghetto, a black kid in the Peoria ghetto, grew up in his grandmother ran a house of prostitution. And he really recreates these characters from his childhood and the whole attitudes, his sort of racial anger and everything that he experienced as a black kid, and brought that into his comedy. Some of it was painful, difficult for white audiences to hear, But I think he did an amazing job in sort of bringing everybody into that world and you know, turning, it wasn't just black comedy, it was comedy for everybody.
Yeah. Would you give us a short list of the comics you talked with for the book?
The comics, I started with George Carlin. I sort of go from George Carlin to Jerry Seinfeld is kind of the era. Carlin was the first guy in the late 60s to kind of adopt, I think, the Lenny Bruce approach. Pryor is in the book. He died, unfortunately, before I could talk to him. Robert Klein, Steve Martin, and Albert Brooks, who went in a totally different direction, but were still very avant-garde comic artists, I think. Jay Leno, David Letterman, who the guys who did the club scene in the L.A. in the 70s. And Seinfeld was kind of the last of the big comics. I think he started in the late 70s and then became very big in the 80s. But that's kind of the span. Of,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
Who talked to me.
Yeah. Were they easy to talk to?
Most of them were. A couple are difficult to get to because they don't like to talk to the press too much, like David Letterman. But I did manage to break him down and talk to him. But most of them are very, very amenable to talking about those days. I think they were really kind of welcome the chance to talk about stand-up comedy. A lot of them have left it behind, like Steve Martin and Albert Brooks went off to do movies. And I didn't know if they wanted to talk about those early days. You know, maybe they just thought of it as their kid stuff. But they were, you know, I think they really do recognize that what they did back then was important stuff and breakthrough in some ways. And so they really enjoyed, I think, the opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah. What do they remember most vividly from their early days? Is there a story or two you want to tell us?
Well, everybody has different stories, of course. Albert Brooks, I mentioned, because he's one person that a lot of people don't even remember. He did stand up. He went off and had a movie career, and he's, you know, a fine movie director. But he was doing amazing sort of self-parodying, showbiz parody back in the late 60s, early 70s. But he was an interesting guy because he was kind of a neurotic performer who, in the end, he just got totally kind of freaked out by performing live on stage. And there was a famous performance in Boston in 1974. He had been doing the club circuit and some concerts and stuff, and he finally just decided he'd gone to the end of his rope in stand-up comedy, and he almost had basically a breakdown on stage in Boston, and he wouldn't do the gig. He was supposed to be on for a weekend. He did one night, and he said, "That's it, I'm not doing it." They kind of forced him. They just sort of cajoled him into doing one more night of stand-up, and that was it, and he stopped, and he has never done a real, you know, stand-up comedy performance since. He's done some appearances on TV shows, on talk shows and stuff, but he doesn't perform live comedy in concert anymore.
In his films, I'm thinking of Lost in America and a great movie. He seems to, though, have kept a little bit of that nervous kind of persona that he did on stage in his film work.
Sure, very self-mocking.
Yeah.
Films like, he started out with a film called Real Life, which I don't know if people remember, but in the late 70s, it was a parody of the old PBS show, An American Family, where for the first time cameras went and lived with a family for an entire year, a real precursor of reality TV, the real world kind of shows. And here was Albert Brooks as a film director who sort of spends a year in the life of in the house of a Phoenix family, and basically destroys the family by just hanging around all the time and doesn't even realize it. You know, he's totally, because he's so sort of narcissistic and caught up in his own artistic vision, he doesn't see that he's destroying his family. So it's really a terrific film.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer and critic Richard Zoglin. We're talking with him about his book, Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Was Albert Brooks, was he in the first version of The Heartbreak Kid?
No, that was Charles Grodin.
Oh, okay.
The link, though, is that's interesting you mention that, because Charles Grodin was actually in Albert Brooks's film I just mentioned, Real Life. He played the father in this family that Albert Brooks, the filmmaker, went to live with. So they actually are good friends, and there is a kind of link there, yeah. Very deadpan, self-mocking kind of style.
I wonder, have you seen the remake of The Heartbreak Kid?
Oh, yeah. Is not very good.
Not very good. The first one was brilliant.
First one was brilliant. And Charles Grodin, actually, I did talk to for this book, too. Not that he was a stand-up comic, but he was kind of in that world. He was friends with Albert Brooks. He was friends with Steve Martin. And a very smart guy and perceptive on the whole subject of comedy. I talked to an awful lot of people and in this book, and it was really great because these are the people that were my heroes. When I was growing up, I used to listen to the records and watch them on TV, and to finally get to really talk seriously with them about their comedy and get them to sort of focus on it and what their influences were and what they were trying to do, it was really a great experience.
Yeah, it was a great time to be a kid and have a little money in your pocket and be able to buy these albums.
Yeah.
You know,
it didn't take as much money.
No. And it was so wonderful. We played them over and over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. I heard all these guys. And I actually, the book also gave me an opportunity to take out all those old LPs that had been sitting around and play them again once I got my turntable fixed. But I had all those old records, and I wanted to use them. I didn't want to go out and buy them again on CD, so I got to use the old LPs.
Yeah. As an adolescent, one of the comics I admired very much and enjoyed very much was David Steinberg.
Yes.
And he's an alumnus of Second City. Another comic who was a favorite, Robert Klein. He also was at Second City. They were there at the same time. What were they doing at the time?
They were not getting along, actually, is what they were doing. David Steinberg was kind of in the mid-60s, had become sort of the star of the Second City company at that time. This is, of course, famous, improvisational group that had spawned a lot of people like Alan Arkin and Barbara Harris. By the mid-60s, David Steinberg was in the company, was doing very well, was very well known. And then Robert Klein came along from New York. He was kind of a struggling actor in New York. Got hired to go to Second City. So they were in the company together doing sketches, I guess a six-person company, and they were in there. Steinberg was kind of the big shot, and Klein was the newcomer, and they didn't really get along. But they both, their stand-up comedy was incredibly influenced by their experience at Second City. Klein particularly talks about how that Second City experience taught him how to act as well as tell jokes, and he sort of combined it all in this really kind of fast-paced, fluid sort of style that was, I always thought, a unique kind of mix of improvisational acting and joke telling.
Yeah. Well, what do you say we listen to a little bit of Robert Klein?
Sure.
This is from the album Robert Klein, Child of the 50s.
I love the harmonica. It's a neat, nifty little instrument. Every Civil War movie, there's always a night before the battle, gathered round the campfire, a guy playing the harmonica scene. Where are you from, boy? Virginia, sir. Sir, you ever been in a battle before? No, sir, but I'm aiming to. Boy? Yes, sir. You better stop playing that damn harmonica. One time, just idly, I was sitting in bed, and I put it in my mouth and breathed. And it played a tune like my breathing up. No hands and breathe. And I thought to myself, this would make a heaven nurse's aide. If a guy is sick in the hospital, a nurse can slip one of these in his mouth, hear how he's breathing, go away, play cards. Any problem, she hears right away, musically. Shoves the oxygen in his mouth and saves him. If he should happen to expire... I love that word. That's what hospital... I'm sorry, he expired yesterday at 2 p.m. Is that pomposity? I'm sorry, he expired yesterday. You don't know if it's a man or a library card. I'm sorry, he expired. Geez, we could have renewed the son of a... What's it tell? Can we still bring the candy? I want to die. I don't want to expire. At least if he expires, it ends on a nice exhale. A major chord. Very final sounding. Take it out. Exhale is out. It's perfect, you know. You can go out your own way. A little pompous, a little style. It's a whole lifetime, after all.
Robert Klein, Child of the 50s. It's so
That's
good
a very,
to...
Very good clip.
Yeah, it's so good to hear these things once again.
Yeah. See, there was Klein doing, you know... First of all, just doing a great little parody of old movies, and then just sort of riffing on. He's got a harmonica in his hand, and he kind of goes, you know, it's there's a lot real improvisational feel to that, just sort of jumping from thought to thought, and it's all very crafted. I mean, he obviously isn't just thinking those things on the spur of the moment, but he makes it feel like it's improvisational. And yet it's incredibly crafted for the laughs. So that's what Klein did so well. And every younger comedian who heard Robert Klein, people like Jay Leno and Jerry Seinfeld, will acknowledge that Klein was like the most influential comedian to them.
Hmm. Well, back to David Steinberg for a moment. One of the things that he talked with you about was timing, not timing in delivery, but political timing.
Yeah.
You want to share with us what he told you about doing political material on The Tonight Show?
Yeah. Steinberg was, in the early 70s, one of the first comedians to start doing Watergate material. I mean, in his clubs, he was doing material about, Nixon and the Watergate scandal. And he was going on The Tonight Show quite a bit. Johnny really liked him. And, in fact, they were friends. But for a while, Carson didn't want him to do the Watergate material because he said the country isn't ready for it yet. And, you know, Steinberg respected that. He felt that Johnny, as people have noted before, Johnny was very good at picking up what America was ready for. And then when Johnny thought they were ready, they usually were. And Johnny was one of the reasons why. When he started joking about things, then people, the rest of the country felt it was all right to joke about them. But Steinberg was doing Watergate material. Now he also had his own encounter with the Watergate with the Nixon dirty tricksters in a story that I don't know if he's told before. It's certainly not at this length. He told me about Steinberg was doing this Watergate material, and one day he was a knock on his hotel room door, and it was a couple of guys who identified themselves as FBI agents, claimed that he was being that there was a death threat against him. And because of his Watergate material, because of his anti-Nixon material, and they were there to protect him. Steinberg was kind of scared. He went on anyway, and nothing happened. And he kept for the next few months. He would be these FBI agents were kind of following him around to try to sort of protect him. It was only a few months later, during the Watergate hearings, that Steinberg says he saw those same two guys standing behind Donald Segretti. Who was Nixon's dirty trickster in the Watergate hearings, and he figured out quickly that those guys were not FBI agents. They were agents of Nixon who were kind of watching him over him because they thought he was one of Nixon's enemies because he was doing this anti-Nixon material on stage. So that's how, you know, stand-up comedians at that time were, you know, really taken note of.
Yeah. Well, I remember a Steinberg line about Nixon is he says something to the effect of, I saw Nixon the other day on the television, and I wondered to myself, why isn't there a sock and a shoe on that?
Yeah, yeah.
He's got a face like a foot.
Yeah. And he was he definitely was out there on Watergate. And he did then, Johnny did finally let him one night, let him do some Watergate material. And, you know, I don't know if it's, I'd have to check it out, but, Steinberg claims it was the first time that, you know, Watergate jokes were on The Tonight Show. And then shortly after that, Carson himself was doing them, and then I think that helped turn the country around on, you know, on that, on Nixon and the Watergate scandal.
Before this period of time, were we so irreverent in terms of sending up presidents?
Well, you know, there was always Bob Hope was doing jokes about Eisenhower and Kennedy, and so there was certainly a long tradition of making jokes about people in power. I think, though, that, you know, like a Bob Hope would be very kind of down the middle in terms of, I don't think it was stuff that could be, you know, either side could take offense at. Whereas I think the new guys definitely felt like they were voices of the counterculture, essentially, in the late 60s, and the, you know, the anti-Vietnam, anti-authoritarianism, all the kind of views of the sort of attitudes that we identify with the counterculture years, freedom of speech and sex and drugs and, you know, anti-authority, calling into question all these sort of 50s, uptight 50s moral values. All those things were, you know, part of what the stand-up comedians were talking about in those years. So to me, they were really articulated and helped, you know, help bring about those changes in the culture that we went through in those years.
Yeah. On the one hand, it seems that this comedy offered us an escape valve, but it also demanded of us that we stand up and sit down.
Yeah, well, it, you know, Carlin, when he was doing pretty heavy duty stuff, and in fact, when he was first starting to do his sort of left wing material, anti-Vietnam, making fun of drugs, kind of admitting that he took drugs and everything, and this was in the late 60s when he grew his hair long and grew a beard, after being a very straight-laced, short-haired kind of comic who did the Ed Sullivan Show in Vegas. But when he started doing that stuff, boy, audiences were not ready for it. They were used to the old George Carlin, and I have many stories in the book about Carlin, that clash with between the audiences he was talking to, the old sort of Vegas audiences, and the kind of new material that he was doing, and he really got into trouble. He got kicked out of Vegas twice, and he had an engagement in Lake Geneva at the Playboy Club in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, where when he started doing anti-Vietnam jokes, the very conservative audience started yelling at him, and he almost started an audience riot. He had to go. He kind of ended the set early. He went back to his hotel room. A little while longer, he got a telegram from the hotel, a telegram sent to a guest in its own hotel, saying that, you know, we can't guarantee your safety any longer. The engagement is over. So that's how bad it got for him. So audiences were not ready for that kind of stuff. A few years later, they were.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Richard Zoglin, our guest today. He's the author of Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. Listeners, you can join us with a question, a comment, with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering where you would put the Smothers Brothers in all this. I mean, it seems to me that the audiences were extremely ready for them, and it wasn't like they wouldn't offend one side or the other.
Yeah.
In fact,
well,
they were the most popular show on TV, but yet were kicked off the air in spite of, you know, being... a profit margin, just surely for political reasons.
Well, that's true. They were definitely right at the heart of this conflict in the late 60s. They were the one, as stand-ups, they were, of course, old, you know, they were a comedy team. They were kind of old-fashioned. I mean, they were a very funny comedy team. But then when they got their CBS show in 1967, they, you know, Tommy Smothers particularly felt that he wanted to be the voice of the new generation, the counterculture. And they started doing... They really pushed the edge of what network TV would allow. They were very, you know, they wore their political, you know, views on their sleeve, and they were anti-Vietnam. They were pushed the edge in terms of sexual freedom and drug humor, and particularly the anti-Vietnam stuff, though, got the network very nervous. It was still a little early, 67, 68. So it was very controversial. But they were incredibly important in sort of pushing, you know, pushing America forward in terms of its attitudes on the war and what was happening in the culture. But they were still working for a network that, you know, when they got calls from advertisers or from, you know, interest groups, they got very scared. And interestingly enough, what finally forced them off the air was not the anti-Vietnam stuff, but it was, lo and behold, it was David Steinberg, who we just talked about, who was doing one of his sermons. He used to do these sort of mock sermons where he would take characters from the Bible and kind of update their story and do it in kind of an irreverent way. And that, when he did that on the air, that's what got, you know, the right-wing religious groups upset. And they started writing letters and calling CBS when the Smothers Brothers were told not to have David Steinberg do another sermon, not to have him come back on the show and do another sermon. They defied the network. Tommy Smothers said, I don't care, I'm going to have him on anyway. Had him on, and that was the event that then CBS canceled the show.
Yeah. In retrospect, those Old Testament stories that Steinberg did are pretty tame.
Yeah, sure. You know? I mean, it was simple stuff. It was just taking, you know, the story of Moses or at Queen Esther or whatever, and just kind of telling it in a modern, colloquial way. But, you know, back then, just doing even mild sort of satire of religion was, you know, something you just didn't see.
Yeah. Maybe you'd tell us the story. I don't know how. I will fail at it if I try it. But maybe you would give us an example of this kind of, this particular, these routines that he did. Maybe you'd tell us the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and Lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it was just the kind of stuff what he would say. Lot is leaving. They're leaving Sodom and Gomorrah with his wife, and they're walking. They're leaving the city, and she keeps saying, "Lot, we should have stayed." And he says, "Keep walking, keep walking." And she says, "Lot, we should have stayed." He says, "Keep walking." He says, "Lot, we should have stayed." Finally, he says, "Dear, God told me to tell you to look back."
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that kind of thing that he did. Now, I don't think that would give anybody too much offense today. And it was really in good spirit. And David Steinberg was a very religious Jew from an Orthodox Jewish family who had a lot of respect for those stories. But he was just having fun with them.
Yeah. One of the many comics you talked with, I also enjoyed as a young girl, as a woman, Joan Rivers, and you describe her as being a transitional figure.
Yeah.
A woman who bridged the gap between comics like Phyllis Diller, who was of our parents' generation, and a pioneer like Elaine Boozler. How was Rivers different from the women who had gone before her? And she was really pushing the envelope as well.
Yeah, she was. On a superficial level, some people thought, well, she's like Phyllis Diller in the sense that she made fun of, oh, looking for a man. She, you know, she made fun of her looks. She made fun of her sex life and that kind of thing, which Phyllis Diller did too. But Phyllis Diller did it in sort of jokes. It was just sort of written jokes for her, and it just seemed like shtick. Whereas Joan Rivers really, you know, talked about her life. I mean, a kid, you know, growing up in Larchmont, New York, son of a daughter of a doctor, went to Barnard, she, you know, everything she said really came out of her own life, and she was not afraid to sort of call it as she saw it. I mean, you know, she used, you know, like she felt her model was Lenny Bruce, who told the truth. Not so much Phyllis Diller, but the, you know, the male comics like Lenny Bruce that she admired for just telling the truth and talking about what was happening. So she, you know, a lot of it was her own life and her own troubles with men and whatever, but it really grew out of a real authentic experience. And plus she would talk about, oh, her gay hairdresser in a way that you didn't hear much in those days. And she was just, you know, very brassy and bold. And, you know, I think she was the kind of female equivalent of the male, you know, the Lenny Bruce type of comics. But she still had that a little bit pre-feminist era, you know, take on things. She wanted a husband. That was her whole thing, looking for a husband. So she came up and became big in like 64, 65, 66, just before the women's movement kind of took hold. So when the women's movement took hold, then the newer women didn't really, you know, want to do Joan Rivers type of material because they were beyond that. They didn't want to talk about looking for a man. So she was caught in between, I think. But a lot of times people forget how adventurous she was as a stand-up comedian for a woman.
Yeah. Now, Elaine Boozler, she was a pioneer. What made her a pioneer?
Well, she was really the first, or at least the biggest, of the comedians who did the clubs in New York in the 70s, who was a woman who did basically comedy just like the men were doing. She talked about, you know, the just day-to-day life in New York, going grocery shopping, dating, going out to singles bars, whatever, but from a real woman's point of view, not self-deprecating and putting herself down like Joan Rivers did, but also not really overtly feminist. She wasn't like, you know, having an agenda. She was just trying to talk about life as she saw it, you know, from a woman's point of view. And, you know, just little things like sitting in the, when she was a waitress and she couldn't stand the customers who would say with their wives, and say, "I'll have this and the lady will have this," you know. She says, "The lady, what is this? What does that mean? I'm the whore or something?" You know, she's the lady. So, you know, that kind of stuff. And women in the audience at that time, I think, you know, they would go to the comedy clubs with their boyfriends and have to sit through mostly guys talking about girls and dating and all that. And then suddenly here was a woman telling those same jokes from a woman's point of view. And that was a real, you know, breakthrough and a revelation, I think, to a lot of, you know, the audiences at the time. She was very big on the club scene in the 70s, and she didn't really have a great career. I mean, she kind of faded a little bit, but she was a real breakthrough and really paved the way for all the women comics who came later, who mostly didn't come along till the 80s, people like Roseanne Barr and Ellen DeGeneres, Paula Poundstone, and, you know, I don't think they would have been possible if it weren't for Lane.
I think she was really exciting. I remember being in San Francisco for a week, and I kept going to this same little bakery coffee shop, and I struck up an acquaintance with a waitress.
Huh.
And she said, "How long are you in town, or have you moved into the neighborhood, or what?" And I said, "No, I'm just here for a week." She goes, "You know Elaine Boozler is in town tonight?"
Wow.
So there was an excitement, I think, among women in terms of, here's somebody you got to see.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she was very admired by everyone in those days, men as well as women.
Why was this period of the 70s so tough for women to get into the business?
Yeah, that's a question I really had to deal with because Elaine Boozler, of the ones who sort of came of age in the 70s, I'm saying Joan, you know, setting aside Joan Rivers, who really came a little earlier, but of the ones in the 70s, really none of them were as big as the men that I talk about. I mean, the George Carlins and Richard Pryors and Steve Martins and Jerry Seinfeld. You know, Elaine Boozler was probably the biggest, and she didn't quite make it that big. So I don't know. I think there was something about that transitional period when the showbiz community was very comfortable with the old style women, the ones who made fun of themselves, the Phyllis Dillers, and even Joan Rivers because she still sort of put herself down. But then these new women comics who didn't put themselves down and really and were a little, you know, racier in terms of sex and you know, and language and stuff made I think a lot of the male, you know, showbiz community a little uncomfortable, and it was still dominated by men at that time, particularly dominated by one man, Johnny Carson, who was so powerful and so important in terms of launching careers as stand-up comedians at the time, and he admitted that he was a little uncomfortable with assertive women comics, and notoriously he did not like Elaine Boozler very much. He had her on once, and then he didn't have her on again, and she was on the show a couple times only with guest hosts. And that was a big, you know, stumbling block in her career. If Johnny Carson didn't embrace you and didn't put you on regularly, you really had a tough time. She also didn't get an HBO concert At HBO was a big venue for stand-up comedians in those years. You know, all the major comedians had HBO concerts, Carlin Kline, etc. Elaine kept trying, and they wouldn't give her one. She eventually went to Showtime, and she did stuff. But anyway, I think that the male-dominated show business powers at the time maybe it was a little hard for them to accept that new style of women stand-up comics.
Speaking of new styles, before we run out of time, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Mad Men, including Sam Kinison and Andy Kaufman. How influential were they, and have they influenced, for example, the British comedian we know as Borat?
Well, definitely Andy Kaufman. I mean, Andy Kaufman was kind of the extreme. He took that kind of self-parody, making fun of show business. I mean, everything he did on stage, it was all ironic. He was a dumb guy, a guy with, you know, the foreign man character or whatever, or a guy who bombed on stage. He was just sort of making fun of bad show business and being so bad that he was daring the audience to see how much they could sit still for. I'm making fun of this, but you know what he was doing on stage. He would read from The Great Gatsby, or he would do his laundry on stage just to show kind of, this is what you'll sit still for, folks. Will you really sit still for this? How long, you know, you wanted to see how long the audience would sit there before they started yelling for him to get off the stage or do something else. So it was kind of provocational comedy, which, you know, wasn't always popular with some of the other comics. But he'd certainly, I think, influenced that whole deadpan, self-parody, ironic kind of approach. And, you know, Borat is a clear descendant. You know, he's playing a character, never breaking the character, as Andy didn't break the character. When Andy played Tony Clifton, his kind of boorish Vegas lounge singer type, he would never, ever break character, never let you know that was Andy Kaufman, even in interviews. When he would do interviews as Tony Clifton with reporters, he would never admit, you know, publicly that Andy Kaufman was Tony Clifton. Borat, too. Borat, you know, goes on
right.
The David Letterman show as Borat, not as
Cohen.
Yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, definitely the same thing. Sam Kinison, different story, totally different kind of comedian, a kind of, you know, a real rabble-rousing provocateur that I think has been amazingly influential. I think so many of the guys I hear Sam Kinison in today, not that screaming so much, but that kind of politically incorrect, I'm going to tell you thing, you know, boy, I'm going to cut through the crap and tell you what nobody else will tell you. You know, this is a really honest kind of comedy in an often politically incorrect way. And I think Sam Kinison has, you know, his influence has really been, has lasted a long time, too.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here, and I think maybe what we'll do is play a little piece of a comic that you write about near the end of the book. His name is Stephen Wright, and I think he owes something to Andy Kaufman. I think also the way you describe him is there's some echoes of Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Here, he came on the scene in the early 80s, and he's still out there. And I kind of think of him as an anti-establishment absurdist.
Yeah, definitely that absurdist approach. Yeah. He was a unique guy.
Yeah. Well, there we'll leave it, and we'll go out with a little clip of Stephen Wright. And this actually comes from Comic Relief 1990, and we'll leave it there. But Richard Zoglin, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Okay, it's been great. Thanks.
Richard Zoglin is the author of Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America.
I was driving down the street past the gas station. There were two signs in the window, help wanted, self-service. So I went in and hired myself. I made myself the boss. I took all the money and I left. I was driving down the street 100 miles an hour for no reason. The police stopped me and they said, why were you going so fast? I said, why? I had my foot to the floor. Sends more gas through the carburetor. Makes the engine go faster. The whole car just takes off like that. And I said, see this right here? See this? This steers it. One time I went through a stop sign, they stopped me and said, why'd you go through a sign? I said, hey, I don't believe everything I read.
Stephen Wright, Comic Relief 90. Richard Zoglin's book, Comedy at the Edge, is published by Bloomsbury.